I'd like to talk to you about the polar regions today, South Pole, North Pole. Try not to lay it on too thick with the environmental science, but come up with a few observations that I've made in the course of doing the trips that I've done, and tell you a bit of an adventure story and a bit about what it takes to do these kinds of expeditions, and give you some environmental observations along the way. And I've had a few little technical problems with one or two aspects of this presentation, so bear with me. The weather today makes this very conducive to talking about polar regions, doesn't it? So, just by way of a bit of a background, yes, I work with URS. I roughly divide my work into threes. I work in the overseas aid sector, where I'm a sustainability advisor to a number of AusAid programs. I work with a group of people in the Solomon Islands, and a very major, very real issue for them is sea level rise. And at the moment, we are experiencing about a 2 millimetre a year sea level rise. That's a United Nations figure, and is really pretty much beyond dispute. I work also in the areas of environmental auditing and management system implementation. So I guess I get the opportunity to see what's kind of coming out of the stack at the pointy end of business, and work also with farmers in the Murray-Darling Basin system. I'm a soil scientist by original training. The other side is, I guess I do a lot of wandering around in these places, south and north. I've been 5 times, 3 times south, twice north. Just to give you just a quick insight, there'll be a film out on the ABC, hopefully towards the end of this year, maybe early next year. I attempted to retrace Sir Douglas Mawson's journey. Mawson is, of course, the balaclava-wearing guy on the old $100 note. And I tried to deprive myself of the food to the same extent as him. Wear the same clothes, pull the same kind of sled, eat kangaroo jerky as a substitute for dog, so don't worry. But I was quite happy to eat. I've actually eaten dog, but ABC wouldn't have it. And it was a very, in all honesty, a very humbling experience to see just what it was that those guys must have gone through, because, of course, for them they had no opportunity of a rescue, whereas for me there was at least that opportunity. I put that shot in really just to show you there's a glacier in the background there. That's about 2 kilometres wide. That represents a pretty small one in the scheme of the Antarctic. The widest glacier in the world is the Lambert Glacier. It's about 100 k's wide. That's actual width. Length is more like 2,000 kilometres, so incredibly large scale we're dealing with down there. Like I say, I don't want to hammer on too much about you know, the science behind the environmental issues, but I take it most people have seen the Gore film and perhaps even the ABC / Channel 4 debate film thing the other night. I can't be too critical of Channel 4 because they were part funders of the Mawson program, so I won't say anything too negative about it. This greenhouse effect, it gets a lot of press. Fundamentally, it's a natural process. There's a term called the Goldilocks principle, which says Venus is too hot, Mars is too cold, and Earth is just right. And it's really due largely to the fact that we have a layer of greenhouse gases which allow a certain amount of heat to be trapped on the planet, which allows conditions conducive for us to actually live. So it's not a bad thing. The issue really is the amount of greenhouse gas in the system which is causing the problems. It basically comes in the form of shortwave radiation, and some is bounced back into space, some gets radiated back, and some gets trapped. And this is because the shortwave incoming radiation becomes longwave when it gets emitted back out, and it gets trapped by the greenhouse gases like methane and carbon dioxide, causing warming. And we're experiencing, if United Nations figures are to be believed, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are to be believed, we're experiencing about a 0.6 of a degree temperature rise globally in the 20th century, roughly. Now, whether or not you want to attribute this to the carbon emissions we're putting out into the atmosphere is obviously the big ticket question at the moment. Personally, I think that it's more or less beyond dispute that we are largely responsible for this, given that, you know, since Industrial Revolution times, 1750s, up to the present time, we have seen carbon levels in the atmosphere go from about 190 parts per million to sort of 380, which they are at the present time. And they're going up by 3 parts per million on an annual basis at the moment. That's an increase from about 2 parts per million. So it's increasing and increasing and increasing. And by 2100, United Nations again are reckoning we're going to experience somewhere in the region of 650 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, with a corresponding temperature rise of maybe 1.5 to 2 degrees, which I'll talk a little bit about the Antarctic and say what that might mean for us. I've spent a lot of time in Russia. They don't really generate electricity by any means other than burning coal, it seems. You go there and everyone's just chucking coal around everywhere to generate heat. But we are putting somewhere in the region of 70 million tonnes of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere each day as a collective unit. Just some implications for up north. This map shows two things. It shows permafrost, which is that layer of permanently frozen ground. That's in the purple. That's as it currently stands. It's the areas here, and this is the furthest south that it goes. And this white area here is basically the Arctic Ocean. It's an ocean which doesn't have many openings into other oceans, effectively between Greenland and Iceland, and then Iceland and parts of Russia over here. Very small gaps, really, and then you've got the Bering Strait on the other side. Largely, that ocean is completely, pretty much landlocked. Any trip to the North Pole, this isn't a typo, any trip to the North Pole involves basically walking on the surface of a frozen ocean. There's no land up there as such. It's about a 1,000-kilometre walk on the ocean. So if you're interested in doing that trip, you obviously need to know the ocean is going to be solid enough to actually walk on, and I'll talk about that in a sec. The situation predicted, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, of winter. That last slide showed what the full extent of winter ice is. This is the predicted extent of winter ice by 2070 to 2090. I'll show you a couple of slides in a moment, but I can tell you for a fact that when I stepped off the northernmost coast of Russia, expecting to step onto solid ice, there was just ocean there, and I actually had to get helicoptered out to the nearest piece of floating ice and then start from there. So you're already starting to see the implications of it. In Russia, they're experiencing terrible problems with permafrost melt, and you know, very obviously this is sort of structural problems with buildings collapsing and pipelines rupturing and that kind of thing, but a very serious issue, for the insurance sector into the future, I suspect, too. And also releasing a huge amount of methane as it melts. A lot of the decaying organic material that's currently locked into a frozen layer of soil is going to release into the atmosphere. And methane, of course, is eight times more problematic in terms of its greenhouse capabilities than carbon dioxide, so that's an issue waiting to happen. What are the implications for your would-be polar explorer? Well, this is me sort of wandering around up there at the end of the winter. If you want to do a trip up north, you have to go at the end of the Northern Hemisphere winter. Otherwise, when you step off the land on either the Canadian or the Russian side, you're going to find water, so you have to go in the winter when the ice extends all the way down to the coast. And the ice up there isn't very thick. You're talking about maybe 10 centimetres thick at the northernmost tip of Russian islands, Siberia, perhaps 20 centimetres, and about 5 metres thick at the actual pole itself. I don't know if anyone saw, there was an article in the paper today in The Australian about a guy who was swimming around at the North Pole. Anyone see that one? I mean, that's a little bit of misreporting, really. I mean, this floating mass of ice is moving around all the time, and you get leads, as they call them, opening up all the time. And so the North Pole is quite often, on the day you get there, you just have to hope that there's a piece of ice floating over 90 north. Otherwise, there's not going to be a North Pole for you, you know. It is constantly moving around, so you do get opportunities to swim at the North Pole if you're stupid enough to want to do that. For me, I wanted to walk there, so of course I needed to know that it was going to be solid enough. This is about 300 kilometres north of the Siberian coast, still with the sun very low on the horizon, ensuring the temperatures were cold enough for the ice to be, or for the ocean to be frozen. But this is what I saw when I got to the northernmost tip of the northernmost island off Siberia. It's called October Revolution Island. It's a wonderfully enigmatic place. It's full of, you know, old Russian early warning stations, and everything is in a state of decay, but it's really fascinating to go around. It's real James Bond kind of stuff. And they've just literally dropped tools and left everything as it is. And a lot of stuff is just buried in the ice, including PCBs and all sorts of other nasties. But, you know, you can sort of, you know, you look beyond that, and it's a fascinating place. But in all honesty, there was about 20 kilometres of open ocean where we had in previous years experienced solid ice up to 20 centimetres thick, which is thick enough for someone of my size pulling a 150-kilo sled to actually walk on. Any thinner, and it's just too thin, and you'll obviously fall through. So the locals there were saying, you know, the area hadn't frozen for 10 years. and it's getting worse. I think we're seeing a definite retreat of the ice from areas where we did get winter ice right up to the coast. A journey to the pole consists really of leaping from one piece of moving ice to another. It's actually a pretty dangerous trip because you can never predict where the ice is going to open up. You pitch your tent on something that looks solid, and during the night it can open. So the sled design had to ensure that if that did happen, we could sort of jump on the sleds and they would float. So all sorts of design considerations when planning a trip up north. And of course you get these spectacular icebergs just frozen into the ice. And it's just a journey leaping from one piece to the next for 1,000 kilometres. In terms of broader implications for us, what currently happens is that obviously we've got a lot of incoming solar radiation down at the equator here. This shows the seabed. The Arctic Ocean is 2,000 metres deep, but it's actually very shallow compared to the other oceans. It's the shallowest ocean. At the moment, what happens is a lot of the incoming solar radiation gets reflected back out by the ice over the pole. And so it keeps the Arctic Ocean extremely cold, and that results in sinking of water. And that sinking water moves from the north all the way back down towards the equator. Correspondingly, the warm, heated water at the equator actually moves back up north towards the pole, and you end up with a circulation happening. It's called the thermohaline circulation, and it's largely responsible for keeping a lot of the cities in northern Europe free of ice, whereas otherwise their latitude would be such that they'd probably experience ice in, you know, for a much greater period of time during the year. This is it very briefly. Basically, orange is higher and purple is lower. So you're getting the cold sinking water coming down from the Arctic because, of course, you've got this area of ice up over the ocean reflecting a lot of the incoming radiation back out to space, about 80%. And the cold water comes down and you get it replaced by a warmer current coming from the south. And this circulation is global. I won't talk too much about that. But obviously implications if we melt this very, very thin layer of ice on the surface of the Arctic Ocean are pretty major for us. This is not one of my slides. I didn't come across this, but I quite liked it. It's an American nuclear sub that's just surfaced at the pole. So it just goes to show you, really, you're not dealing with large thicknesses of ice. This is probably only 2 meters thick. The Russians, not to be outdone, took a nuclear-powered icebreaker and went straight through the pole. And it's quite something when you're walking on what you kind of, in your own mind, perceive to be a solid surface, and you see a ship coming, it's an interesting thing. And, there are very interesting things that happen to you in the course of these a trip up north. Down south, which I'll talk about in a second, is at least a solid landmass, and you achieve a certain distance covered each day. When you get to the tent that night, you can sort of sit there and switch on the GPS and see how much you've done, and you can sort of mentally start to break down the enormity of the task into manageable pieces, constantly sort of chipping away and moving forward. In the Arctic, there's a very real possibility of being shunted backwards by this ice, and that happens quite often. And we ended up on a conveyor belt of ice going the wrong way for quite a period of time. And 18 kilometres backwards we went one day, and you're only travelling about 20 forwards, so it's pretty demoralising. and it means you've got to come up with a whole series of new mind games to play to motivate yourself. This is a great shot. This is a polar bear in Hudson Bay in Canada. We've actually started to experience polar bear drownings because, they're adept swimmers, but we're getting a situation now where they're happy to swim from ice floe to ice floe and actually drowning out in the ocean, something that really had never been reported before. This is anecdotal, of course, but something that had never been reported before. There are about 20,000, something like that, polar bears up there. Interestingly, when you go there, because you go at the end of the winter, in order for the ocean to be frozen enough to actually walk on, you're going at the same time as the polar bears kind of emerge from hibernation and are hungry. You see a couple of slow-moving guys pulling heavy sleds make a perfect target. So we got harassed quite a bit by bears, and luckily didn't have to shoot one. I often say this, but I borrowed a gun off an old grizzled old Norwegian hunter on my first polar trip, and it was a bolt action Lee Enfield 303. It was, in other words, you've got one bullet in the breech and one more. And I'd never used one of these things before, so I said to the guy, what happens if I miss? Referring to how the hell do you reload one of these things? And he said, my friend, you miss one of them, you deserve to die. I took his point. Switching south, this is a shot taken at Macquarie Island, and you're not actually allowed to land because of the penguin colonies there. But this is a massive penguin colony. As you can see, there's about 1 million breeding pairs there, and sitting in amongst it conspicuously are these things known as digesters, which were used historically for sort of chucking penguins in and melting them down to get oil for, you know, lubricating bullets and you know, machinery and stuff like that. Nice stuff. But, you know, our relationship with the Antarctic has been a little bit questionable. Following penguins, we got involved in fairly extensive seal culling, again for the oil. You know, this is an immature male elephant seal, probably 2 years old, and it's got a lot of blubber. They're amazing creatures. The mature males are sort of 5-ton animals. You know, they're sort of 5 or 6 meters long, and they just lumber along. But we used to melt them down similarly for oil. And of course, whales again. And this is a sort of a money shot that I fluked off a ship. We took down a group of 90 photographers. They were all on one side, and I was on the other side. They popped up my side. I took the picture and kept quiet. You know, it's just a lucky shot. But certainly whaling was also something we were fairly extensively involved with. And I put these in really to demonstrate the fact that our relationship with the Antarctic has only gone back about 100 years, and we managed to cause quite a lot of damage in that fairly limited timescale. The first person to actually spend the night on the Antarctic was in 1895, so we've only really had a kind of 112 years of sort of physical contact with the place. And we've managed to cause quite a lot of disruption already. Now, these are obviously killer whales. They've never really been hunted, but the southern right whale, of course, was very popular. It was known as the right whale because it was the right whale to hunt. So when you harpooned it, it didn't sink. Hence the name the right whale, rather than the wrong whale, presumably. What was I attempting to do when I was down there? I'll just give you a little bit of background about my South Pole journey and then come up with a few little environmental observations, I guess. Just to give you an idea of the scale of the place, I mean, this is obviously Australia. Australia is 7.8 million square kilometres in size. And Antarctica, as you can see, is that much bigger. It's about 14, so it's getting on for twice the size. I won't go into it too much here, but there are actually four poles. There's the South Pole, which is the one that I was interested in getting to here, which is the point, which is the most southerly point on the planet. There's the Magnetic Pole, which is the source of the Earth's magnetism. That's caused by molten rock swirling around in the core of the Earth. Both the South Magnetic Pole and the North Magnetic Pole are nowhere near the geographic poles at either end. They're about 1,500, 1,600 kilometres away from the geographic poles. Hence the variation you get on your compass when you're looking at either magnetic or true north. You've got a couple of other ones that have been thrown in. The geomagnetic pole is where the magnetic pole would be if the Earth were uniformly magnetic, which of course it's not for some reason. And the wonderfully named Pole of Relative Inaccessibility, which is a Russian construct, and they had to come up with a complicated name. And it's the point on average furthest from any geological coastline. And you can just see how distorted the map of the continent is by the ice, given that that doesn't look as though it's furthest on average from the coast. It looks like it should be there, but it's because the ice distorts the map. How much ice? Well, this is all ice here, of course. This is a mountain range, probably 3,000 metres high, just poking through this mantle of ice. A vast amount. Of the 14 million square kilometres of the Antarctic, we've got about a 2 kilometre average thickness of ice over the whole of that area. That's an average figure. So some places far, far thicker, other places obviously a little bit thinner. You've got 14 million square kilometres times a 2 kilometre thickness. You've got 28 million cubic kilometres of ice in that cap. Imagine 1 cubic kilometre is obviously a vast piece of ice. You've got 28 million of those. It's about 90% of the world's fresh water by some estimates, certainly between 80 and 90%. There's about 2 swimming pools worth of drinking water for every man, woman and child at the current population level in the Antarctic cap alone. If we were to get melting of that cap, which again, to go back to our friends at the United Nations, could happen with, say, a 2 degree rise in temperature. We could see that melting within a 600-year time frame. We'd end up with about a 90-metre global sea level rise, which would be a very interesting thing. Just incidentally, that slide, this is called a nunatak. basically a rock outcrop. It's a word taken from the northern hemisphere, from the Inuit people, and it's really the summit of a mountain, and that mountain there is about 3,500 meters high. Only the top 300 meters actually stick through the ice. The rest is buried in 3 kilometer thick ice where that picture was taken. So I easily climbed to the top of that, ticked off a 3,300 meter high peak. Just didn't tell anyone that I got, you know, the first 3,000 were free. But, you know, that shot was taken about 650 kilometres from the pole, and there were lots more mountains between that shot and the pole itself. It's just that none of them were actually physically big enough to poke through the ice, so you're skiing right over the summits of the mountains. What sort of things we've been experiencing recently? We had those icebergs off New Zealand recently. They were part of a massive berg that we encountered on a trip to Antarctica. I was there from December of last year to April of this year. We had to steer around this berg. It was 80 kilometres long by about 15 wide, a massive iceberg. Not as big as the Larsen B ice shelf, which is a bit that broke off some years ago, the size of Belgium, I think it was. You know, massive, massive amount of ice. And really, whether or not we get icebergs further north really depends on the direction of the wind and currents and things like that. I mean, there's always icebergs carving off. It's a question of where they end up. And on this particular occasion, some icebergs actually escaped the southern weather pattern and actually made it up to New Zealand. Certainly, they're so vast that they could do several journeys around the world without melting. It's a case of whether the wind and the currents carry them north. This one here is a very small one. This is about 2.5 kilometres by. We choppered in and landed on a relatively flat section in here. What was I trying to do? I went there in 1999 with the plan to try and cross the whole thing on foot, and we started at a point out here. This is near where Shackleton's boat went down in his famous journey, and this area is called the Weddell Sea around here. And Shackleton, of course, with the boat having sunk, he and all of his 28 men went back to a place called Elephant Island and then set off on a 1,200-kilometre journey in an open rowing boat, essentially, across the open ocean to reach a whaling station and raise the alarm and save all of the men. And ironically, of course, about half of them died in the First World War, which was raging at the time, the following year when they got back from that. So it's out of the frying pan into the fire. But anyway, we wanted to start our journey over on this side here, traverse this area, this little blue line here that's not very well marked, I'm afraid, but this blue area here is the edge of what's known as the Ronner Ice Shelf. And this area here is a large bay about the size of Victoria, probably, that rises and falls with the tide. It's about 1 kilometre thick on the landward side and maybe 100 metres thick on the seaward side. So it's a huge volume of ice moving up and down with the tide on a daily basis, which means you've got crevasses all the way around the edges where the ice rubs up against the solid rock of the continent. And our plan was to basically start here, trek across this, which is about a 300 kilometre wide stretch, up through the mountains, through this stuff here called sastrugi, which is a sort of a wind-blown surface of ice. Some of it, you know, 2 or 3 metres high, very tortuous kind of surface, and up to the pole. Now, unlike the north, which is just basically a position in the ocean, and if you're lucky enough, there'll be ice there the day you get there, down south, the South Pole is 3,000 metres high. There's a functioning US scientific facility there. The scientists live in a kind of strange subterranean world underneath a sort of geodesic dome, a silver dome, and you kind of go down underneath and in. Within the dome is a kind of a space-age little city in there. And people live in, effectively live in sort of shipping containers, which are like an inverse of a refrigeration unit in that they're warm inside and, of course, the outside temperature is sub-zero. It's a fascinating place. And the plan was to get up to there and then from there traverse down through the mountains again and down onto the Ross Ice Shelf, which is the biggest ice shelf of them all. This is where Scott and his men died, tragically only 13 miles from their final food depot back in the... early part of the 20th century. They physically just weren't able to lift themselves to go another 13 miles to save themselves. And it equated to only 300 metres or so a day of distance they weren't covering from the point at which Scott realised things were going pear-shaped and they weren't going to make it. He wrote in his diary, you know, if we could just cover a bit more, we'd make it. But at the rate we're going, I just don't think we will. And, of course, accumulation of those 300 metres and they fell 13 miles short and all died. to get to there, and then go to McMurdo, which is the joint American-New Zealand base on the far side. It has the unfortunate distinction of being the most polluted harbour in United States territory, given the amount of hydrocarbons and heavy metals that have been dumped there over the years since 1957, I think, when it was established. Too difficult, too costly to remediate, too much danger of in the process of trying to dig all the stuff out and physically remove it, actually disturbing it and causing problems. So they've left it. Unsupported trekking in these places involves basically pulling a sled. As I say, the one up north was much deeper than this, designed to be able to sit on with all of my food in the back and actually float if the ice opened up. This one was just built for lightness. You don't have that problem down south, of course. We carried about 220 kilos of food and fuel and equipment for the total crossing, which is 2,700 kilometre journey. And we bargained on 93 days. We had 90 days at 30 k's a day and 3 days of freeboard in there, just in case. That was the plan. And you pull it pretty much like a pack horse pulls a car. This is Peter, you can probably tell. It got a bit like that. You needed that to remind yourself sometimes. This sort of snotty thing here is precisely that. It's a kind of a combination of breath and snot and all that sort of stuff that comes out as you're going along in minus 30 degrees. Any moisture in your breath freezes. It remains moist until the point it comes into contact with your balaclava, and then it starts dripping. As soon as it starts to drip, it just freezes, and then you get an extended sort of a stalactite-type arrangement going on. And these would get quite impressive and quite long. Some days you'd just see who could grow the biggest one and that kind of thing. It's the sort of stuff you do. But really pretty bitter, pretty unpleasant. How do you do these trips? I think you've got to spend a lot of time planning them. In all seriousness, you approach the how at a whole series of levels. Philosophically, why do you want to do it? How do you get time off? How do you plan these things? How do you raise the money, because they're expensive exercises? I'm not going to go into all that now. But they are major, major exercises. And, of course, you've got to have a correct level of physical fitness and mental fitness for knowing that you're going to be able to break down the enormity of the tasks you've got. Not much snow in South Australia, so I used to pull this ridiculous tyre around by way of training for pulling the sled. And I used to pull it down one of the metropolitan beaches, and I just used to get stopped by people every 5 minutes saying, "What the hell are you doing pulling that tyre down the beach?" So I had to take my tyre and go to the outback and start pulling around up there, which is a ridiculous exercise, really, but very good for training. We got dropped off. We had to, a lot of the costs associated with mounting one of these trips involve the logistics, as I say. I mean, you've got to find someone who's prepared to fly you and drop you at this GPS reference on the edge of the Weddell Sea, which you've just sort of made up yourself. And through satellite photography and things like that, we had decided on a particular spot, found out what the GPS coordinates of that were, and we paid a couple of Canadian pilots several hundred thousand dollars to fly all the way down from Canada, bunny hop across from the southern tip of South America to the Antarctic, go back, taking some fuel, fly back again, bring more fuel, and then take us to the start of the trip, and then fly back to South America and wait for us to call on a sat phone. Simple, but it took a lot of organising. This was home for 93 days. This is Peter again, without the name tag, but again, you can see the amount of ice that builds up. You've really got to keep everything covered. I appreciate I'm going to be talking about global warming here, and of course it's incredibly cold, but global warming manifests itself with a lot of movement of the ice off from the edges of the continent, and I'll talk about that very briefly in a sec. But exceptionally cold, exceptionally cold. The Canadians have a rule called the 30-30 rule. It says in 30 miles an hour of wind, in minus 30 degrees, skin freezes in 30 seconds. So you've got to keep absolutely everything covered all the time. This is Peter about a month in, with all the kind of frostbite damage you can see around the face and things like that. Life in the tent was an interesting experience with one other bloke for an extended period like that. And I won't go into that now, but this is the principal food source. This is a kind of a muesli nut multivitamin mix with some raisins and stuff like that, and some powdered milk, together with olive oil. Olive oil was the principal fat source, so we would eat about 400 mils of olive oil each a day, just to keep the fat levels up, gave us about 7,200 calories a day. And during the course of this, I lost 18 kilos. So it's a great place for weight loss, if that's your... it's perhaps the most revolting thing you can ever eat. And another aspect of the planning, you eat this in advance of going. So if sitting in Adelaide, I'd be eating my cornflakes with olive oil on, just to become accustomed to it. You can't afford to get there and find that you have stomach problems, with ingesting olive oil from nothing to suddenly it forming a staple in your diet. So very interesting. Breaks would just be for sort of, 5 or 6 minutes. Any longer than that, from going from a state of being completely hot from working hard to being completely frozen to the extent that the blood was just out of your fingers, a completely numb, deep tissue numbness, not just a little bit of numbness in the fingertips, could take less than 10 minutes in those conditions. So you've got to get up and keep moving again. The thermoses were really just to keep the contents liquid, not to keep them hot. So water would just be kept liquid by keeping it in the thermos. And the effect that all this has, of course, is, as I say, massive weight loss, a lot of frostbite injury. I've still got quite a few appendages which seem to be permanently numb, various toes, the thumb on the right hand, and that sort of thing. And I lost teeth down there. I was walking along one day and realised there was something loose in my mouth. It was, in fact, a molar from the back of my mouth. And the filling had contracted in the extreme cold and just dropped down. And lost three teeth in that fashion, and had a dental kit with me, so I was able to administer some repairs during the course of the trip. And after doing the first one, it was so painful, I decided to just leave the other two as they were. But I got back to Australia, and the dentist said, "Who the hell did this work?" it's just one of the many things that get thrown at you when you're down there. And the enormity of the place, as I've said, it is absolutely vast. From an environmental point of view, it's fascinating because it's really it's the product of a climate which no longer exists there. So it's the driest continent in the world by a long way. When we talk about Australia being dry, we had 37 days, I think it was, with no rain in Adelaide about 5 or 6 years ago. People were getting the record books out. Some places there, we've had no precipitation for 250,000 years. Really incredibly, just an altogether different order of magnitude. The ice cap is really a historic feature. It's not being constantly replenished by fresh precipitation. A lot of the blizzards that Mawson talked about were the same old snow being blown around, not fresh snowfall. There are some areas where, of course, there is snowfall occurring, but there's a lot of areas which are incredibly dry, and you've got to come to terms with that. You've got to come to terms with the enormity of the place, and often it was a very, very solitary exercise trekking along there. I was there with a partner, but often we'd be travelling great distances apart at a speed that we felt comfortable with, and you have to have all sorts of mind games to occupy yourself and keep yourself going. And of course the moods are ebbing and flowing all the time, and you've got to have techniques for managing those. Crevasses, obviously a major issue. When you've got, it's a no-brainer really, when you've got such a vast thickness of ice, a crevasse can be incredibly deep. This is a shot taken from a kind of a moving camera, which is why it's a little bit distorted. It's not a superimposed picture of people. If you've got 2 kilometres thick of ice, only 10% of that thickness is already a 200-metre deep hole. So if you fall in one of those, you're really not going to come out. This is the sastrugi I was talking about, an amazing feature, and we had 500 kilometres of that pretty much in a row, with not an area the size of a tennis court that was flat, and you have to pull your sled sort of in and amongst all this. How do you cope? The Dalai Lama, I think I always say this, but the Dalai Lama says there are two types of problems. There's the ones you can overcome, in which case don't worry, and there's the ones you can't, in which case don't worry. And I think you have to sort of I think you have to have that kind of mindset for doing this sort of stuff. The pole, as I say, is at 3,000 metres high, and it's got a scientific base there, and this is what marks it. It's actually a mirror ball, which is a bit strange. And so you walk up and logically enough, you take a picture into it and you get a kind of a distorted reflection of yourself in that mirror ball. And of course it was there designed originally for taking pictures of the night sky, the aurora. Before they developed fisheye lens technology, they took a photograph with a conventional camera into a reflective sphere, and they got a kind of reflective image of the night sky. It's quite a clever way of doing it. And it was interesting because as we approached the pole, after 47 days, I saw some figures. We hadn't seen anything at all, no evidence of humanity whatsoever, no vapor trails in the sky or litter or aircraft or anything else. And to see the buildings at the base as you come up on day 47 was an amazing experience, to put it mildly. And I saw a person moving around in the distance as we approached the base. And, you know, scientists there are wearing very, very thick layers of clothing to protect themselves against the cold. We dress very, very thin, but they wear very thick clothes. And we almost crept up on this guy, and he looked around and saw us coming. And next thing we had, five or six of him and his colleagues coming towards us, all head to toe in all these visors and things, and there was no skin showing. And it was the heart was really, you know, really going as these two groups of people approached one another. It was really quite an amazing experience. Anyway, we only spent 5 minutes at the pole, and then we headed off towards the other side. I don't propose to talk about that now, but I've put this in because these tracks mark the tracks made by a vehicle that leave the pole and go out and measure atmospheric air quality at a point sort of 5.5-6 kilometres away from the pole itself. And the, you know, the news is not good, obviously. The news, as I say, really relates to the levels of carbon that are in the atmosphere as a result of largely, to my knowledge anyway, our activities. You know, If you break down the fundamentals of the argument, I mean, greenhouse gases are something which naturally occur. They're caused by gases like carbon dioxide and methane. They do insulate the Earth. It's why we're here and why life exists on this planet. You juxtapose that with the fact that we are churning out a tremendous amount of this stuff into the atmosphere. Of that, there's no doubt. We've got the highest levels in 650,000 years by some people's estimates, 20 million in other people's estimates. I don't think there's any coincidence that those correspond to the same 200-year period that we've actually been burning fossil fuels, quite frankly. I think we make very fundamental judgments about many of the aspects of the way we run our lives based on much less information and much less certainty than that which we're presented with this sort of information. I think the evidence is really there that we are causing a major impact. I thought I'd just finish with a few myths that I keep hearing. I mean, the first one is one I've just sort of largely expounded on, the fact that there seems to be this fundamental issue with believing whether or not it is that we're causing a major contribution to the current levels of temperature rise we're experiencing. And I just find it a little bit difficult personally to understand how people can really, with any degree of conviction, argue the counter-argument. This is Davis Base, where I had the good fortune to spend 5 weeks, and this used to have quite a bit of snow around, but of course now the cap is back about 10 kilometres from the base. So it never changes. It's always this lunar landscape. I spent 5 weeks at this base after my latest expedition that finished in April. Another thing I hear is that, temperatures are rising, but that results in more evaporation from the sea and more snowfall, and therefore the cap's growing at the same rate at which it's losing ice at the edges. Not really. We haven't experienced from any of... There are almost 100 bases in the Antarctic. The vast majority are on the coast, but there are the Russians and the Americans and the Italians have bases inland, and there are some automatic weather stations too. We haven't really recorded any significant increase in the amount of snowfall that's occurring in the Antarctic from any of these locations. What we have experienced is a massive increase in the speed at which calving is happening off the side. I've actually pinched this diagram because I quite liked it. Essentially, because we're getting a lot more melt through warmer temperatures at the heads of a lot of the glaciers, and Antarctica is shaped like a bit like an upturned soup bowl, so the ice basically goes from the middle towards the edges. There are a few variations on that, but that's essentially what's happening. Because we're experiencing greater melting further up, you get a lot more meltwater that's going through to the base of the glacier, and it just lubricates the ice at the base of the glacier. And you're actually getting an increase in the speed of the glaciers. And, you know, there are 50 or 60 major glaciers in Antarctica which are being monitored in this fashion, using the same kind of technologies as used to monitor tectonic plate movement. So absolutely infinitesimal amounts of movement can be recorded. We're talking metres here rather than the millimetres, which are used for the tectonic plate measurements. And we're quite simply seeing a greater amount of carving of ice into the ocean due to two things. One, increased temperatures only by fractions further up where you're getting the accumulation of the ice, and a reduced incidence of sea ice around the edges here. And the effect that sea ice has is to actually hold up the glaciers. Once the sea ice is removed, the glaciers can calve that much more quickly. Now, these aren't my figures, but of the 60 glaciers being observed currently, they're experiencing about 10% more calving than they had in the past. So we're getting a lot more ice flow occurring from these major glaciers. As I say, the scale of some of these things are quite vast. If you take the Lambert, it's 100 kilometres across. And there's a project there called the Loose Tooth Project, which is looking at the ice shelf into which the Lambert flows. It's called the Amory Ice Shelf. It's the third biggest in the Antarctic, a vast area. And there's a huge section, about 200 by 50 kilometres in size, which is threatening to break off, and they're measuring the extent to which that crack is increasing. And that's, they believe, largely due to the effects of a small increase in temperature. Another one I hear is, this is taken in Chile, this shot. I climb as often as I can too when not doing the polar trips, but it's about 6,000 metres high, this volcano, quite spectacular. But I hear a lot of talk about the amounts of greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere being negligible compared to natural sources. The New Scientist recorded recently, if people read that journal, it's a pretty respected trade journal, that emissions from human sources account for a far larger proportion of the carbon going into the atmosphere. It's something like, I think, volcanic eruptions account for about 8% of human contributions in terms of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere each year. So, again, not a tremendous amount of credence in that argument. This is a largely unsuccessful attempt at a little dissolve, where the map of Australia dissolved to show you what would happen if we had a 90-metre global sea level rise, and for some reason doesn't seem to be working. But rest assured, the majority of the cities end up in the ocean, effectively. If you had a total melting of the cap. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's not going to happen. And that may well not happen, but I can tell you this, that certainly a lot of engineering projects like marina developments and things like that only build in a small amount of freeboard into their calculations. Glenelg Marina, which is the largest South Australian development, only built in 20 centimetres of freeboard. That's not very much in the context of the kind of sea level rise you could see over a period of decades. It's not going to work, is it? No. What can we do? Well, this is a shot of us coming back from our South Pole trip, thrust into the limelight in front of the media and that kind of thing, complete with beards and being asked about what next. And at that stage, we hadn't done the north, so we said, well, we'll go north. And, a fascinating journey to have undertaken. What can we do about it? Well, I mean, from someone who works a lot in the environmental management system side of things, I've noticed there seems to be there's the sort of the mainstream business that gets operated, then there's environmental thinking that's a sort of a bolt-on at the end. I sometimes wonder whether the environmental management aspect of the way businesses get run shouldn't just be integrated fully into the way that businesses get run. I think it's probably the worst thing for it to have it sitting out to the side, because people perceive it to be a cost. They perceive to, regard it as something that's not going to contribute to the bottom line, whereas I feel that there are great opportunities in areas like waste minimisation, energy optimisation, to look at environmental issues. Often there's a bottom line reward to be had from looking at those things. Well, I did a lot of work with Holden's, and they had exactly the same issue. They had an environmental management system here, and then they had making cars. As soon as they got rid of their EMS and actually incorporated that thinking into the way that they looked at optimising their performance, they started seeing quite a significant improvement in performance. It's just when it's sat out in the environmental area at the side there that people were kind of put off by it. I think I'm going to finish there, because I think I've used up my time. I'll be off the stage, but thanks very much for your time.